from the Sky News Centre at 5. The lawyer of a 14-year-old girl with terminal cancer has defended her wish to have her body cryogenically frozen. Just before she died, a court allowed the groundbreaking move to bring her back to life one day. Her divorced parents had been split on the decision. The child's solicitor is Zoe Fleetwood.
This case was not about the rights and wrongs of cryopreservation. It was about a child's wish to be cryopreserved, and because she was 14 and she was not 18, she was not able to make a will by herself.
A major 10-year refit of Buckingham Palace will cost £369 million. It means the taxpayer-funded sovereign grant, the money paid to the Queen, will rise by 66%. A group representing 600 child sex abuse victims has described the official inquiry as a botched job after withdrawing from it. The Shirley Oaks Survivors Association argues it's so stage-managed it lets the guilty wash their hands. Members claim they've not been contacted by Professor Alexis Jay, who took over as fourth chairwoman in August. But Drusilla Sharpling, who sits on the inquiry, denies that.
We are absolutely determined to carry this inquiry forward because we want to hear the voices of victims and survivors who have never, ever had the opportunity to have their story heard.
A man has died in police custody. The watchdog, the IPCC, says concerns were raised about him during a routine check at Southall Police Station in West London this morning. Football's governing body is to expand its investigation into the wearing of poppies at last Friday's England-Scotland game. Players from both teams had them on armbands. FIFA's disciplinary committee will now look into all acts of remembrance to mark the Armistice Day World Cup qualifier at Wembley. That's the latest.
Yo, it's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for St George, Steve Pearce. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, all along the watchtower of Bristol's city walls, a new series on authoritarian Britain examining the building blocks of the police state being assembled around us. Briefing one tonight on surveillance. Journalist Kevin Carhill looks at the criminality behind the Snowden revelations and the echoes of the Nazi profiling of the 1930s that was to lead to mass rounding up of humans across Europe based on their ethnicity and based on their beliefs. Also postponed from last week, the religion of war. We look back to the last Republican president, President George W. Bush's Iraq victory speech. How hollow his words now seem. Plus the brave new technocratic world. Where have we heard that before? Tonight we listen to author Aldous Huxley. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour, as he does every week, of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 degrees, wet and possibly icy. This weekend, highs around 10 Celsius, sunny spells and showers. Windier on Sunday, though. Next week, highs around 10 still, wet and windy at the beginning of the week and at the end of the week, but sunny in the middle of the week. Next weekend, the 26th and 27th of November, highs around 7 Celsius and sunny spells next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review the week, this week's news is Councillor for St George, Steve Pearce. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me back, even though it's been 3 years.
I know. I should apologise. I mean, in fact, there's so many councillors, you can't get them on all the time. It's also worth noting that there are some councillors that just will not come on, however much you ask them, beg them, plead with them, try and send surreptitious messages through them through other councillors who are supposedly their friends. People like John Goulandris, most impossible to pin down. This man from Coutts Bank really doesn't seem to want to come on the radio at all. I don't know if I should doorstep him, but I mean, that seems to be the only way to get the guy to come and have a chat with us. I mean, what's he got to hide? That's the obvious question. Over something like 6-7 years of doing this programme, never managed to get hold of him. There are one or two others, and for Christmas Christmas, I will do as I usually do, a city slackers report, which is all the councillors that don't seem to want to come and talk to us, even though they're very happy to take your votes, folks. Anyway, Steve, tell us a bit about yourself. Thanks very much for coming down here, taking the time and trouble to do it, as some others haven't. Tell me a bit about your background. What brought you into politics?
Well, I retired early due to redundancy. And
from where? From what?
Well, I worked in the chemical industry for nearly 30 years at Avonmouth. And eventually they made me an offer that it was impossible to refuse. And needing something to fill my day, I started working for a couple of local charities. Then, after the 2010 election, I thought, well, I need to get involved and wear my heart on my sleeve now. Having been involved in politics with a small p, you have to be careful about who you offend, because you might want help from a Conservative or a Liberal Democrat councillor at some point, so you can't afford to upset them. But after 2010, I had to get involved. So, and it's been downhill ever since, really.
So why Labour?
Always Labour. Father was Labour, mother was Labour. It was never going to be anything else. Trade unionist all my life, so no, there was never a debate.
Why, for example, did you join a trade union? Why not? You know, what drives you to do that?
When I
just your parents' habit.
Parents, pretty tribal. Had to join a trade union when I started work. There was no question about it. You joined the Transport in General because that was the union. So
we've come a long way since then with the unions, haven't we? And I think I can remember chatting to people that worked in Fleet Street, years ago. Is actually you go to the union and the union will get you a job.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we've come a long way since then.
We have come a long way since then. In some ways, perhaps some of that was good and needed doing, but I'm pretty confident that it's not all been good news.
What's changed?
Well, the loss of the closed shop means that a lot of people don't join a union now until they find they need urgent representation. So that's a worry. Because there doesn't seem to be as much inequality in the workplace as there used to be, people perhaps don't feel the pressing need to do it.
Also,
I'm not sure that's true either.
What's the future for unions then, as a union man yourself?
I think that the pendulum swung back too far, and we'll see an increase in trade union membership. It'll be different unions because it's a different workplace now.
But you do need a bit of a disposable income just to pay your subs every week, don't you?
You do. But it's not a lot of money. It's pennies a week, isn't it? So
pounds a week, surely, at least.
Yes, but it's only a few pounds a week, isn't it? A pound or
okay,
so.
And what do you get? Okay, this is your chance to make your pitch. What do you get for your, whatever it is, £5, £10, £20 a week that you pay into the union? What do you get for it?
Well, you get representation. You get access to a lot of services because unions don't just do representation in the workplace anymore. You get access to union education. And historically, the first access to post-school education has been education through the union, and trade union education has always been very highly regarded.
Just to add to what you're saying, I think it's fair to say that unions are more democratic than political parties. If you want to get involved in politics in one way or another, electing a leader for a trade union is more democratic than, for example, Theresa May, who hasn't actually been elected as leader by the membership of the Tory party. Also, of course, many more members, people are actually members of trade unions than they are of political parties. So you do think, well, actually, here you've got a democratic reserve which is slowly being whittled away in Westminster, Steve.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Although the recovery of the Labour Party membership, we're up to over 500,000 members now, is very cheering, I find, which probably lets you know which side of the which wing of the party I'm from.
Well, why would someone who didn't vote for Jeremy Corbyn, say who voted for Owen Smith, why would they think that it was a good idea to have this split this year?
I don't know, but it's the party's a democratic organisation. We've had two leadership elections now. I don't think there's any doubt about who should be in charge. And if you're a Democrat and I'm a Democrat, whatever the result is, you go along with it.
What about Brexit then?
Yes, I rather fancied Brexit might come up. I was a Leaver. I was a Leaver because I thought that actually the economic opportunities exist outside of Europe rather than inside of Europe, and I see Europe as having been less democratic than it could or should have been. I was outraged when other countries had referenda and they were ignored and made to vote again until they came up with the right answer. I think that's absurd. It's plainly lunatic. And I wasn't surprised at the Brexit vote. I was surprised and a little bit shocked that some people were surprised. And now that we've had, and I suppose you're going to raise Trump later, aren't you? Well, let's get him out now. Now that we've had the presidential election and Trump has won, I wasn't surprised at that either. The thing that surprised me most and shocked me most was that out of a population of 300 million people, those were the candidates they came up with. Surely not the cream there, is it, in America?
So which side would you have preferred to see win over in the States? I mean, I know obviously it's a different country, not really any of our business, but we talk about it quite a lot.
We do talk about it quite a lot.
We're part of this American empire, aren't we? We've got American air bases here. Every military mission, the Americans point to Iraq, we go, etc., etc.
Well, I would have voted for, out of a field of two, I would have voted for Hillary. I'm not surprised that Trump won. I'm disappointed that Trump won. I'm disappointed, actually, that Bernie Sanders wasn't the Democrat candidate. I think that, I don't know whether Bernie would have done any better than Hillary did, but as I say, I can't see much further than, is this the best that they can do? I've just got to say that having not been surprised at Brexit and not having been surprised at Trump, we've got a lot of referenda and elections coming up in Europe next year, and I won't be surprised by any of the results that come out of that.
So
either.
Do you think there's a sort of move to secede from Brussels going to spread around? I mean, the Brits have started things, ball rolling a bit here, haven't we?
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot of people in Europe who aren't very happy with the way that Brussels has run things. And the Brexit vote and the election of Trump shows to me that there appears to be a movement of hundreds of millions of people who not only feel they've been left behind, they actually have been left behind. And there are going to be a lot of them in Europe as well, so anything could happen in Europe. It's going to be quite an exciting year next year.
I think we should ought to bring Old Dave Roxford economist Martin Summers in here, because I know what you're going to say, Martin. You're going to say this whole thing to do with Brussels and Brexit is a total sideline. We should be focusing on what's going on in the city, and it's all about to collapse. But mind you, you have been saying that for a few years now.
I have. Do you want me to repeat it again, or should we just move on to the next thing?
So, I mean, why do you... I mean, I think really what I'm saying here is, what about this secession, this attempt, it seems, to just... bypass the Euro establishment, the Brussels establishment?
Well, that may be the case, but you've also got to think of Catalonia breaking out of Spain, Scotland breaking out of the United Kingdom, Texas maybe leaving the United States. I mean, you know, I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, so you get Slovenia declaring independence from Yugoslavia, then Croatia declares independence from Yugoslavia, then the Krajina and Dubrovnik declare independence from Zagreb, and eventually you ended up with real splinter states, like the Bihać pocket, which was Muslims under the Muslim warlord Ferenc Abdic fighting on side of the Serbs against other Muslims.
So you're saying there's going to be a civil war?
We've already seen this in the Ukraine. Yeah. Crimea. And then the Donbass and Luhansk.
And that really was a competition, surely, between the Russians.
All of these breakaway movements are part of wider strategies, geopolitical strategies. The real fundamental thing that's going on in the world is the fight by the US oligarchy, backed by Britain and Israel, to contain the potential Chinese-Russian alliance and so on.
Literally 4:30 today, half an hour or so ago, announced some big appointments to Trump's cabinet. We've got three people, that is Jeff Sessions, Michael Flynn and Mike Pompeo. All of them apparently are quite controversial people. Sessions has been offered the job of Attorney General in Donald Trump's cabinet, most right-wing anti-immigration members of the Senate. We've also got this chap Michael Flynn, retired Army Lieutenant General, offered the job of National Security Advisor. And also Mike Pompeo is offered the job of CIA Chief, Republican Representative for Kansas, 4th Congressional District since 2011, Harvard Law graduate, which represents Wichita, a member of the conservative Tea Party movement, served as a canvas representative too. He backed Marco Rubio for the Republican nomination. But Martin, I think the one you're going to want to talk about is the middle one, isn't it? Michael Flynn, an interesting character, is going to be part of the US cabinet, apparently.
Well, Flynn was in charge of the NSA? There was a Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, wasn't he? And Dempsey was in charge of CENTCOM, who was his ally. And as Kevin Cahill's going to be on later, as he pointed out, both Irish names. Flynn was unhappy with the CIA's policy of backing ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And he wanted when he was at the DIA, he was passing information to the Syrians and to the Russians. And he also got pushed out. And he also leaked an internal DIA analysis that ISIS had in fact been encouraged and put in the field by the US and its allies, that is to say Turkey.
Yeah, I mean,
Qatar,
I think the actual
Saudi
quote
Arabia,
is it was a willful decision.
A willful decision. Yeah. Now, in other words, that's sending a fairly clear signal that Trump is going to back off on this trying to overthrow us.
Look, it's also worth mentioning yesterday James Clapper tendered his resignation. He was the US Director of National Intelligence. He'll be going in January. So this seems like quite big shifts in American intelligence going on.
It is. I mean, you know, I feel very conflicted about what's going on here, because Hillary basically was saying we're going to have no-fly zone over Syria, and Dunford, who was the head of the armed forces in the US, and he's pretty hardcore, he was saying, yeah, but that will mean we're going to war with Russia, and she's saying, yeah, well, let's do it. I think Trump is backing off on that now.
Silly girl.
Well, I know, but you'll find that lots of liberal opinion in the West really thinks that we ought to go to war with Russia over Syria. Even though, in actual fact, we've been supplying Al Qaeda and the ISIS all along.
Has anyone
done since the 1980s, as the Russian generals
are well aware.
Has anyone told
them how well armed the Russians are and how they might just give us a bloody nose if we decide to do that?
That's why people like Flynn and Dempsey, who are senior military in the US, eventually turned around to their political advisor and said, "You are bonkers. You are going to drive us into a war with Russia, which we're going to
lose." Yeah,
well,
maybe quite a few of the American voters were listening to that too. Who knows? Anyway, Steve, look, on the bigger picture, what do you think of these announcements today and the change potentially in American stance?
Well, I'd just like to pick up on what Martin's just said, saying about ending up going to war with Russia. I mean, surely that plays into Mr. Putin's hands, doesn't it? Because he desperately needs a foreign enemy to distract from his economic troubles at home.
Well, I don't think he needs a foreign enemy. I mean, I think Putin is actually quite popular, and the sanctions against Russia have not had the effect of making people turn against him. I mean, basically, people are saying, "Well, that's the West being nasty to us, and we're Russians, and we can dig our heels in like anybody can dig their heels in." Putin has basically doubled people's wages since he came to power.
Just to add something, I'm not sure if you come across this. This is just literally yesterday. I read this. Russian's economics minister has been arrested and charged with corruption.
The stuff I've been reading about that is that there is a pro-Western faction within the Russian state apparatus. And with Trump's election, Putin is now moving against them because he feels he can. Now, some people may not like this, but actually, you know, is it sensible, I suggest, to people in Britain and elsewhere, when we've got our own economic troubles, to deliberately try and bankrupt the Russian economy? Because that's our policy.
Well, I mean, OK, so maybe this is
the eighth
maybe
biggest
this
economy
is because,
in the world, and if we were to be successful in bankrupting them, which we're not, we would only shoot
maybe,
ourselves
maybe
in the
this
foot.
Is because Putin feels a bit more confident. He started when he first came to power, didn't he, by getting rid of certain of the key oligarchs, and he's been working to push the oligarchs out. These are the people that took over
he
the big privatised... Can I just finish my sentence, please? These are the people that just took over the privatised parts of the national state. And, of course, we're going to be coming to this later here, but you'll find a lot of the people on the Bristol Rich List, the top 50 richest people in Bristol, which we're going to be looking at with Kevin at the end of the hour, they are also people who've taken over what used to be state industries, have been taken over, and
well,
suddenly people have made a lot of money out of them.
That's how you make money. He's a friend of mine, friend of yours, Adrian. His father used to run the British gas industry as a nationalised industry when it was privatised, and he ended up running it as a privatised manager. His salary was massively increased, just like that. He was doing exactly the same job, but now he's worth 4 or 5 times more than what he was as a nationalised industry manager.
I mean, we're not seeing it here in Britain, say, for example, the business secretary being arrested for corruption, are you? I mean, maybe there's infighting going on within the Russian state. What do you make of this arrest this week over there?
Well, it's... Putin has got rid of a lot of the oligarchs who must have been a power centre in Russian society. I know very little about Russian society, but I would have thought they represented a serious power centre in Russian society. And anyone who's potentially a political threat probably needs to... is probably going to be encouraged to leave through the side exit as well. So, I mean, he's making his position secure at home everywhere he goes. That's what he's been. It's what he's done all along, it seems.
Well, we have an oligarchy in this country. They don't get talked about quite in the same sort of terms. This is, say, the rich and powerful, and as I say, we'll be talking about them. We're talking about the Hargreaveses and the Lansdowns, these kind of people, really almost invulnerable to paying tax.
Well, we don't have a state. Well, we do, I suppose, we do have a state. A state press and media over here, or some elements of it, but some elements of the press and media are owned by oligarchs as well, so they're unlikely to out themselves, are they?
No. One of the interesting jobs you do is chairing the West of England Joint... What's it called?
Joint Scrutiny Committee, yes.
Right, OK, so this is a really important job to have someone like you on there. I mean, just tell us how it all works. There is this thing called the West of England Partnership, isn't there?
Yes.
Is that all that you're scrutinising as part of that committee, the way they spend our money?
It is, but we make... we give advice on policy matters to the leaders of the four authorities that make up the... partnership, on what things they should spend their money on, things that they're being advised to spend money on. We give advice as to whether that's a good idea or not, whether there's something else they should look at. We also have started looking at things that actually they don't directly fund or involved in, but may have an impact on the West of England. So we've got a scrutiny session coming up in a couple of weeks where we're going to be looking at the Hinkley Point power station and the impact that's likely to have on skills in the West of England, because that's going to be a huge vacuum cleaner hoovering up all the brickies and all the steel fixers and throughout the area. So that's going to make getting anything else done in the area more difficult. And we need to have a coherent response to how we handle that that impact.
Now, I mean, we did a show on here a few weeks ago, I'm sure you were listening, but with Paul Mobbs, environmental consultant, and he's done all the figures based on this MayGen project up in Scotland for tidal power, saying effectively it would be half the cost to do tidal power to generate the same amount of power as Hinkley nuclear, and then and also that includes any kind of, I mean, the thing is with Hinkley Power Station, as I understand it, the insurance is paid for by the government, and the waste treatment afterwards is also paid for by the government. That means us paying for it. So why is...
Where's the financial risk? If someone else is dealing with all the bad stuff, where's the risk?
Well, there isn't any, is there? So, I mean, I suppose it's a bit awkward for you to say, no, we don't really want you to do this. But, I mean, surely someone should make the point to them that they're spending twice as much as they need to on something which the public are going to have a massive bill for in the future, instead of doing tidal power, which would be much more green as well.
Thank you for making the point. I've always been opposed to nuclear power on the basis that it is nuclear. I'm not sure that we can't do better. I'm terrified by the price that we're going to have to pay for this electricity. The cost of renewables is coming down all the time.
So why are we doing it then?
I've no idea. That's way above my pay grade.
But you're on the scrutiny commission. You've got to know.
Yeah, well, we're not paying for it. That's the thing. We're not paying for it, but we are going to suffer impacts on skills.
Well, anyway, so if people don't want to spend $37 billion on a nuclear plant and would rather spend $15 billion on a tidal plant, which would generate the same amount of power, maybe we should think about doing that instead.
Please write to your MPs.
I'm not sure. Who is the best person to write to on this? Because I'm not sure the MPs would really be able to make a difference.
I should just write to your MP, because if you write to anybody else, say, sorry, I don't represent you.
I suppose that's the only thing you can do. But anyway, look, the West of England Partnership is spending hundreds of millions of pounds of our money.
It is.
In fact, actually, Marvin could do with a few bob of that.
Yes, he could. We could. We deal with transport, housing, strategic planning, so we do get an awful lot of benefit, but also impact from it. And making sure that that's appropriate and that the impact that that's going to have is one of the jobs that I and my colleagues on the Joint Scrutiny Committee get involved with.
So who are the West of England Partnership and how open are their meetings, since they're spending our money? You would hope that...
They're public meetings. I have to say, it's not a crowded room when we meet, and it would be nice if it was. It's not webcast, but the minutes are all in public. The meetings are held in public.
Whereabouts are they? You know, where are the meetings usually held?
Well, the meetings, they go on the road, and the meetings are held all around the area. So from time to time, you can get one, ideally, that's close to you. So we meet regularly at places like the Bawa Club in Filton. We meet in the centre of town. And we meet in Bath or in Keynsham and down at Weston.
And who's on there?
It's elected members from the four constituent councils, which is Bristol, Bath and North East Somerset, South Gloucester and North Somerset. The leaders board is comprised of Marvin from Bristol and the leaders of the three other authorities, and the scrutiny committee is made up of elected members taken from each of the four authorities.
Now, am I right in thinking that this is partly the sort of same kind of organisation, which is they're talking about this having this Metro Mayor running? Because, you know, you've got the four authorities. Is the Metro Mayor tie up with those four or not?
Well, it's an interesting and very confusing situation in that we've got an organisation of four authorities at the moment. When the Metro Mayor comes in, we'll have another organisation representing three authorities, but there will be relationships between the two. Now, North Somerset has elected not to join into the combined authority, but we will still, as a combined authority, want to work with North Somerset, and there will be some projects, such as Metro West, the local rail initiative, that will run on into the period of the combined authority. So there will be a need to talk between the two organisations, have that relationship, and it could be very interesting for anoraks like me.
Metro West almost reminds me of Metrobus. Aren't the West of England partnership also quite key there? Because a lot of people have been tearing their hair out over this Metrobus, all these delays, and it doesn't even look as if there's going to be maybe only 3 Metrobuses an hour, which doesn't sound as if it's going to really make much of a difference to congestion.
Yes, unfortunately, Metrobus has been something of an unloved child. Not everybody is keen on it. A lot of people are very anti it, but it's coming down the track. We've spent a lot of money on it. I think at the end the price tag will be something in the region of £200 million.
So am I right in saying that with Metrobus it's happening because the money was there for it, rather than because this is the great super sexy scheme that we all wanted?
Yeah, you're right there. I mean, the people of Bristol, I think, wanted a tram originally. This is going to get me back into trouble at the office. I think the people of Bristol wanted a tram. They didn't get a tram. At the time that we were looking at what was going to pass for a mass transit system around Bristol, Metrobus was the only game in town. So that's what we've got. And you're right, someone came along with a big bag full of money and we said, yes, we'll have some of that.
So sort of like it or lump it offer.
Yes, and I'm in trouble in the office. So
so when are we actually going to, when is this thing going to start rolling?
Well, dates. All of these projects in the west of England have been getting pushed back and pushed back. I'm hoping that the first buses will start running at least on some part of the network. I mean, it's a very large network, but I'm hoping that the first buses will be running on parts of the network at some point next year. You're not going to tie me down to a closer date than that.
Okay, Steve. Also, you've worked in pensions, haven't you? You still did. And this is one of the things I know you were telling me earlier you did when you retired, started getting into being a pension trustee. I wonder, how do pension funds survive when we're living in this world now where you've got virtually zero interest rates? Because surely a whole point of a pension scheme is that they're making money on investments and then using that to reinvest and also to increase the size of people's savings. I mean, are you still able to do that on pension schemes?
The short answer is it's really difficult. Assets in pension funds are doing quite well at the moment because stock markets are still doing quite well. The problem for pension funds has been that the return on government securities has been so low that deficits are increasing all the time. So while our investments are doing well, unfortunately our liabilities, the pensions that we've got to pay in future years, and a lot of these pensions are going to be paying money to pensioners for another 100 years yet, and having to put a value on that when you're assuming that the income that you'll get from your government investments, which you use to pay the pension fund, you use to pay the pensions, is so low. So you need massive amounts of assets to pay for those liabilities.
I mean, for those who have got these private pension schemes and state pension schemes, I suppose more and more people possibly in the future having to fall back on a state pension?
Yes. Yes, I think it's highly likely that that people will depend on the state pension. It'll be the only thing that they will able absolutely to depend on. There'll be so much uncertainty around pensions. I shouldn't say this because people will be selling off their pensions in droves now. But it is difficult. There is a lot of uncertainty around that. People have for decades now been investing in property as a form of pension instead. And it's why so many people, why it's so difficult, one of the reasons why it's so difficult to get on the housing ladder.
I suppose if people are looking at the stock market and thinking this is looking a bit shaky, especially with all this quantitative easing money pumping it up a
yes.
bubble on the stock
yes.
market, you know, and the same yep. I suppose with assets like houses.
That's right. I mean, they look at houses and they say, well, you know, for a long, long time we've all said, you know what, there's nothing as safe as bricks and mortar. And that's true, but unfortunately you've got a larger number of people chasing us, an ever smaller number of houses. And if you look at any new development, quite often you'll find that it'll be advertised as an investment opportunity, a buy-to-let landlord. You see property shows on the TV, and it looks as though everybody's doing it.
Property porn, Tim Tate calls it. Former ITV producers that we had on here. The idea is just to sort of make everyone think this is normal. Everyone else does it, so why can't you just buy a house, do it up? But of course, at the end of the day, it's meaning that a lot of people just simply cannot afford to pay the rent, Steve. I mean,
That's right.
Other thing is, if you're looking at how much it actually costs in bricks and mortar and labour terms to build a house, we've come a million miles away from that in terms of what it costs to rent one every week.
Yes, yeah, it is. Housing, you'll be aware that housing is one of the biggest issues that we face in Bristol. Marvin's concerned about it. Paul Smith is wrestling with it. It's another not easy problem.
What's the City Council doing about it then?
Well, we're planning to build, 2,000 homes a year, and of those, some 800 or 900 each year will be affordable. It's difficult to get affordable houses built in Bristol at the moment.
Why is that?
Because developers say that it's difficult, it doesn't fit their model. They can't afford to put them in there because essentially they pay so much for the land that they buy, and they pay so much for the building. They do a thing called a viability test, and government planning legislation now has made it very difficult for us to rebut those viability
tests.
Well,
there's one good bit of news this month. In the Guardian on the 4th of November, housing associations have now been added to the Bank of England's bond buying scheme. So it looks as if it might be a bit easier for housing associations to get money from some of this QE money to go building houses with, Steve.
Yeah, that'd be nice. That'd be great. I mean, we, you know what? We need as many houses as we can get. We're in desperate straits. As a country, we need probably 270,000 homes a year just to stay still, just to stay where we are before we make any impact on the backlog.
Well, part of this is to do with migration, isn't it? We've got something like 300,000 people a year net coming into Britain.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons, I think, why a lot of people voted Brexit.
Well, talking of Brexit, let's go on to Prime Minister's questions here, where Jeremy and Theresa, I mean, I really think Jeremy Corbyn seems to be losing it because he's asking the same question six times. I mean, if he could have six different questions, then surely, you know, he would look a little bit more credible. He also seems to have given up this idea of taking questions that people have emailed him completely. And here he goes, banging his head against a brick wall, saying, as a Ramona, really, saying, oh, you haven't got the Brexit right six times. But anyway, here he is questioning Theresa May about Brexit, and she talking about how our wonderful free press is going to save us all.
Democracy is also underpinned by the freedom of our press.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeremy Corbyn's question was of defending the independence of the judiciary. We all should be doing that. Mr. Speaker, we have an international development secretary who's opposed to overseas aid. We have a health secretary who is running down our national health service. We have a chancellor with no fiscal strategy. We have a Lord Chancellor who seems to have difficulty defending the judiciary. We have a Brexit team with no plan for Brexit. And as has just been shown, we have a Prime Minister who is not prepared to answer questions on what the actual Brexit strategy is. We need a better answer than she's given us.
Tell the Right Honourable Gentleman what we've got. We've got an International Development Secretary delivering on this government's commitment to spend 0.7% of GNI on international development. We've got a Health Secretary delivering on £10 billion extra funding for the health service. And we've got a Chancellor of the Exchequer making sure we have the stable economy that creates the wealth necessary to pay for our public services. But what we certainly have got is a leader of the opposition who's incapable of leading.
Yeah! Well, that's Theresa May, the Prime Minister there, very politely having a go at Jeremy Corbyn's Prime Minister's questions. But Martin, we have got the autumn statement next week. Do you think there's any prospect of Phil Hammond making any difference as the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, now George Osborne is history?
Well, he's already made a difference because we've given up the idea that we're going to balance the books by 2020. That's just gone out of the window.
But it never was going to happen anyway.
Well, it was never going to happen anyway, which is what we, the Labour Party, has been saying all along, right, left and centre. So, in actual fact, the Tories have given up on everything that they claimed that they were doing for 8 years. And they've just given up on that and decided that that balancing the books doesn't matter anymore because Brexit has changed.
What would you like to see next week from Phil Hammond?
Well, I think in a way it's positive that they have decided that they're not going to try and balance the books because it was a silly idea in the first place.
What would be your spending tax priorities?
What he should do is given the fact that the zero interest rates, we might as well run a bigger deficit and invest in the future. And I don't mean by that building Hinkley Point. I mean doing something sensible, like, you know, training a new generation of IT specialists, whatever, you know, investing in housing, an obvious win-win. I think what will happen is that the Tories are going to tiptoe in that direction. And of course, they're not going to mention the fact that everything they've been doing for the last 8 years, they've just decided to throw out of the window. But they have. But then they won't go in any. They're not going to go because they've still got to keep some kind of credibility about keeping the deficit down. They won't go in the right direction. And they're also still talking about tax cuts, which is absolutely ridiculous. If we're supposedly paying the deficit off, there is no case for tax cuts whatsoever. But there you go,
Steve. I wonder if I ask you the same question. If you were Philip Hammond's shoes, what would you be your priorities next week?
Well, I'd want to spend money on infrastructure, but I wouldn't want to spend it on the big centralised projects like HS2 or Hinkley. I wouldn't want to spend it on things like that because those large projects take a long time to get off the ground, and it's a long time before you start to actually put money in ordinary people's pockets.
Well, there's also I was going to say with HS2, for example, there's big questions over the financial case for it. They were having a look at saying, well, this is going to save 20 minutes of loads and loads of very great wealth generators' time. And if you total it all up, well, anyway, but they hadn't considered that maybe these people could do some work on the train.
Yeah, that's right. And I use the train a lot, and I work on the train all the time. It's in many ways, it's better than working in the office because you don't get the same kind of distractions. But I'd spend money on infrastructure, on local infrastructure. So I'd like Philip Hammond to give Bristol City Council some money so that we can immediately start building some houses. We can immediately fix some roads, fix some potholes. That'll put money in my constituents' pockets immediately, and we'll see that. I expect Martin talks all the time about the velocity of money, and if we increase the velocity...
No, he doesn't really.
He doesn't. Oh, well, I'm just lobbing that one in his direction so we can stick it in the back of the net.
Martin, you've been out economic jargon there.
But I think we could do a lot better if we used that additional government spending locally, where we can make a big impact quickly rather than putting it in a bricklayer's pockets 5-10 years from now on a large infrastructure project centrally.
Okay, also another story this week, NHS plans to close hospitals and A&E departments has been kept secret from the public. An investigation finds NHS bosses keeping cost cutting plans leading to hospital and A&E closures secret from the communities they'll affect. An investigation has found health managers in 44 areas of England ordered to draw up strategic plans setting out how they will reduce costs, change services and improve care in the wake of a record 2.45 billion deficit, but they've been told not to reveal plans to any of the public or the media until they're finalised. Well, it sounds that then they're apparently going to do a consultation after they've been finalised, Steve.
Yeah, that's what it sounds very much like, doesn't it? I'm getting a briefing on this shortly, I think. So, yeah, I'm as much in the dark as everybody else. I'm not best pleased about it because I've seen what's appeared in the papers and it doesn't look good, and it doesn't look big, and it doesn't look clever. We've just heard on your snippet from Prime Minister's questions about £10 billion being spent in the health service. Anyone that works in the health service will probably tell you that's not enough.
Also this week, GP closures could leave 5 million people without access to their local practice. A total of 210 practices have closed in the last year, and they reckon 750 may follow. This is Shahib Khan in The Guardian last Saturday. More than 5 million patients could be left looking for new GPs after 10% of practices claim they're at risk of closing in the next year, Martin.
Well, that's, I mean, there's never enough money for these things. And, of course, there's never enough money when you've got an artificial austerity policy preventing you from spending the money that ought to be spent on things that it should be spent on. Meanwhile, of course, we're still effectively subsidising the bankers through quantitative easing.
Another big change over the last couple of weeks is forces are going to lose a string of historic bases that the Ministry of Defence sells off 56 sites. This was last week's news, really. We didn't cover it last week. Apologies for that. Armed forces are to give up a string of historic bases and barracks and the biggest shake-up of the military estate in decades. MOD announces it's disposing of 56 sites, including Woolwich Barracks in London, Fort George in the Highlands, and several Royal Marines bases will be sold off. The lease is given up as the MOD tries to save billions following the Defence Review. Michael Fallon, or his sword maybe, the Defence Secretary said the estate was too big and costly to run. Well, of course, this land is going to be sold off probably to the major housing developers, Steve.
Yeah, it probably will be, yes. I can understand that there's a push to sell off government land to make it available for housing. That's fine if it's in the right places. But I suspect that as a nation and as a continent, Europe has been taking peace dividends long beyond the times when it should have been taking them. So we may well regret the loss of some of this real estate to the defence.
Can I just mention, Tony, that we're actually building a new base in Bahrain? Because not that the people of Bahrain want us there. In actual fact, they're protesting against the Al Khalifa family, who were left in power when we quit Bahrain in 1971. They're protesting. They're trying to kick them out. But the US Fifth Police Fleet is based there, and to keep the Americans happy, we are going to spend our taxpayers' money on building a new base in Bahrain. And of course, it could turn out into a serious situation where our forces are actually going to be attacked by the Bahrainis because they don't want us there.
Well, I wouldn't like to be the MOD suit that has to go and turf out 40 commando from their base in Taunton, Steve.
No, he might come a bit unstuck there.
Okay, anyway, back to Prime Minister's questions, and Lisa Nandy talks about the historic child abuse, sex abuse inquiry. More bad news from them this week, I'm afraid.
Lisa Nandy! She doesn't seem
to have very much control over world events, but she should at least be able to get a grip on the child abuse inquiry that she set up. In 2 years, it's lost not only 3 chairs, but now 8 senior lawyers, the latest citing further concerns about competency and leadership. She will be surely as aware as I am that there are further serious allegations that have been made to the inquiry panel that have gone uninvestigated. So cannot she tell us whether she shares the full confidence in the inquiry that her Home Secretary expressed some moments ago, and if so, why?
Well, I recognise the importance of this issue to the Honourable Lady. It's one on which she has campaigned, and she champions the cause of those who are... She champions the cause of the victims and survivors. And, of course, like her, it is the victims and survivors that we must always keep at the forefront of our minds. That's why it's important that this inquiry is able to continue. And I agree, this point was made this morning by her right honourable friend, the new chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee. We owe it to the survivors and victims for the inquiry to continue. And I have to say, having seen the work that Professor Alexis Jay has done in the Rotherham inquiry that she undertook, I have absolute confidence in her ability to undertake this inquiry.
Well, I mean, this is dragging on and on and on, isn't it, Tony? As you know, keep hearing this inquiry is going to take place, and then people get appointed and they just disappear. Fundamentally underlying all of this, as I've said week after week, is that, as was shown at Kinkora in Belfast, is that the intelligence services have used paedophilia as a blackmail tool, and that's the real iceberg that we're looking at here.
Also today, the Shirley Oaks Survivors Association has pulled out of the inquiry, saying that the failure to manage the investigation means we have been abused again and again, over and over. And the main criticism of Alexis Jay as this new chair that's been appointed by the Home Office to do this job is that the inquiry that she ran up in Rotherham didn't actually lead to any kind of disciplining or suspension or prosecution of any of the public servants, any of the police or social workers involved in this massive scandal up in Rotherham that had been running for 15 years. Anyway, Steve, what do you make of this horrible event?
Well, it's a desperately, desperately disappointing series of events. We
this inquiry has been needed for a long time. It's the whole thing's not been run well. It looks a complete shambles. In fact, you could almost say that we now need a public inquiry to investigate how we set up public inquiries, because we've done so poorly at this. But it's a complete nightmare for anyone that's been involved in it. And government's shown itself to be pretty much incapable of organising it.
Now, Kevin Cahill's turned up on the scene. You were also involved with Exaro News. I know you were part of the media operation trying to get something done about this, Kevin. Also, for the Shirley Oaks people, what they're saying is that this is just compounding the abuse, effectively.
Yep. You'd remember a guy called Peter Wanless, who's chair of the National Society for Protection of Cruelty to Children, who told us all in his report that A, MI5 said they had no files, and B, there were no records of abuse at children's homes. And you know the colleague of both of ours, you and me, who found 129 files on children's homes that were rendered secret for 100 years. And they were all in the manual files at the National Archives. And Wanless didn't even know they existed, or if he did, he didn't even look for them.
Part of the problem here has got to be, really, that the Home Office is itself implicated in this abuse scandal. Leon Britton was Home Secretary. This goes a long way back.
Well, the real problem is that Theresa May was in charge of MI5 for 6 years. It's much closer than you think.
So in what way are the security services implicated, Kevin?
Sorry?
In what way are the security services implicated?
Well, Martin has mentioned blackmail, but there was something else they did. They used the homes to recruit agents. So there's two issues they're trying to cover up. One is the routine use of the homes to select vulnerable kids to become agents. And the second thing is the utterly routine use of the homes and the kids in them to blackmail people in authority usually.
Now, clearly the survivors are going to have to agree with whoever is in charge if someone else is found after Alexis J. Is that going to be an impossible thing to manage, to have the survivors of child sex abuse actually say, well, yes, this person we've got confidence in? Because they have put some names forward, for example, Michael Mansfield, haven't they?
Michael Mansfield would be forensic, incisive, and is not afraid of the security services or anybody else. He would be ideal, but mostly because he's so forensic. He will call a spade a spade. And that's what Alexis J won't. She will not tackle any more than Wanless did. You know, the real powerhouses.
But anyway, we brought you in to talk about something completely different, Kevin. Maybe we could just move on to that now, which is the rich list. This came out last month in the Bristol Post, the top 50 rich list total. Actually, we did a little bit of calculation and found that the total wealth of these people, that is the published wealth, and of course, as you know, someone that worked for the Sunday Times on the rich list, someone's published wealth is often smaller than their real wealth. Let's just take Prince Charles and the Queen, for example. The total of these, it comes up to 31.25 billion pounds that they have. Anyway, I just wondered if you could take us through some of the headline figures from here and see what you make of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good list. It's up to Sunday Times list standards, but it's very conservative. And the one that jumps out at me is Prince Charles. Prince Charles is worth about $1.5 billion. The Sunday Times list is very conservative, but if the estate which he owns, the Duchy of Cornwall, is properly valued, you're talking about $1.25 billion.
Well, he'll probably say, well, actually, I'm just a sort of trustee of that estate. It's not my private, personal bit of land.
But he makes all the decisions. He gives the orders to the Duchy Council. And, we're all trustees. But this is garbage. You know, he owns the estate. It's just like nobody's followed up, and that includes the Sunday Times rich list. When the coalition government took power, they handed the crown estate to the Queen. I'd always said prior to that it was hers. When I read the documents, and it was perfectly obvious it was her estate, you know, as Mrs. Windsor. And the Tories overrode the Liberal Democrats, who hadn't a clue what was going on, and said, no, we're going to give the Crown Estate to the Queen. So she is now the owner. And the Crown Estate is worth, properly valued, about $14 billion. Rich lady, our sovereign.
She certainly is. Prince of Wales from up in...
But she's just about to get $400 million from us to patch up the palace.
Oh, $400 million?
Yep.
I'm sure she can afford to do that herself. I mean, how come she gets state benefits while people out there are on food banks and starving and can't manage to get them?
Now, interestingly, the palace actually does belong to the state. It's one of the very few bits of her properties that is a kind of office, which it actually, officially, if you like, go through the documents. Buckingham Palace, and there's somewhere else, there's two of them, are actually offices. So we get to pick up the tab.
So if you think Prince Charles is worth $1.5 billion, and they're saying here only $150 million, can we add a zero to some of these figures,
yeah,
do you think?
I think the list is fairly, it's okay, pass muster, but I think they are just valuing his property around here. They didn't say where is all the rest of it. That, what they put him in there for, is about what Highgrove is worth.
Okay.
Really nice place.
Yeah, but it's certainly not his only wealth, is it? And he's down at number 23 on the rich list. So if I was really super rich, I mean, some kind of Donald Trump character, could I pay the Bristol Post and the Sunday Times to sort of make my name slide down the list down to about 30 or 40, even though I was number 2 or 3?
Well, you know how the palace got the Sunday Times rich list changed? They phoned Murdoch, the palace, and said, well, putting the Queen at the top wasn't fair because we were confusing her private wealth with her public wealth, i.e. we were throwing in the Royal Art Collection and Buckingham Palace. In actual fact, I never did that. I always included the Crown Estate because I'd read all the Crown Estate documents and it belongs to her, not the state.
Steve Pearce from St George, Labour councillor. What do you make of all of this? Because we heard last week, that almost all people who have wealth over £1 million are avoiding tax in one way or another.
I'm going to take the fifth on this one. I'm not the journalist in the room, but yes, you know what? I think they very likely are, because they're going to be employing accountants. If I'd probably employ an accountant, it probably goes with the territory.
Sounds almost a bit feudal, doesn't it, when you're in this sort of position? You've got all these kind of little feudal followers that run around trying to, do PR for you in a way, whether it's to do with money or whatever.
No, it's not accountants as such. They are way down the trail. The use of offshore tax havens really started in Buckingham Palace with the Crown advisors before the Second World War.
Okay, Kevin, thanks. And also thanks to our guest Labour Councillor for St George, Steve Pearce, after the news. All along the watchtower of Bristol's city walls, briefing number one tonight on surveillance.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.